Second Data Talks. I'm Sadiqa and my co-host for today is Yen. Our special guest is Jesse Murrell. In today's topic, we discuss what neurodiversity is, the challenges that come with being neurodiverse in an office environment, and how you can channel being different into becoming your superpower. Let's talk. Hi everybody, welcome to the Black in Data Talks. I'm joined today by the awesome Yen and Jesse Murrell. Jesse, could you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. So as you said, my name is Jesse Murrell and I'm currently working as a software engineer. I've had a bit of a weird journey into data, but I've worked for a few tech companies, a few startups, a digital marketing agency. I ran a baking company for a little while, which was a bit odd and interesting. Now I'm just working in tech as a software engineer.
Cool. So do you want to maybe tell us about your career in data, your journey into data? How did it start and all the fruitful things that happened in between?
Pun intended.
Yes.
So my journey into data kind of in retrospect feels inevitable, but kind of ad hoc, because I kind of was always interested in finance and economics and things like that. And I studied like finance economics at GCSE and then at A-level and then at uni. And then I did like financial mathematics and financial economics at uni. And I guess kind of data and big data is kind of, I guess, statistics at scale, right? Like when it's valuable, it's like big data. So it's kind of like in theory, always going to progress that way. But I guess when you kind of have to go into like tech for it to be like operating at that scale. So I think it was always going to go there, but my journey into kind of like software engineering, data engineering was slightly odd because I worked in finance for a little while as an actuarial analyst and then investment consulting and then had a bit of a weird time doing that. I think I was, if I'm honest, a bit bored in investment consulting. It was a weird career path for me, I think that particularly with kind of the way I am neurodivergent, very dyslexic, a lot of that was like very admin-y, and that is like the admin is the worst thing for a dyslexic person to be doing. So then from there I kind of left finance and then trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life, and then started a baking company for a while. Quickly realized that I love making like a beautiful cake or like a really cool cupcake, but hate making like 200 of them. So then from there I was like, oh, what's similar to baking, and decided to learn to code because
very similar.
It actually is similar. So like
okay, so when I first heard this story I was like, what?
Yeah,
baking is similar to coding.
It actually is similar, like maybe not like when you witness two people doing it, but the feeling that you get, or at least the feeling I got from them, was similar. Because and even, I guess, is similar, because when you bake, you have a recipe, which is, I guess, your instructions or your code, and then you build that thing. It's quite a creative thing to do, and you get instant gratification when it's done. So, like, you have your instructions, you do it, you test it, and you see how it came out. That's the same as, like, writing some code, solving a problem, and seeing whether it solved that problem. And if it didn't work, you go back to the drawing board.
I'm convinced, yeah.
So when your code runs and it's accurate and everything is correct, that's the gratification.
Yeah, like when that happens and I write some code and it works the first time, I feel like the smartest person who's ever walked the earth. And when I bake a cake and the idea that I had in my mind comes out exactly as I like imagined it to be, I had the exact same feeling. But then also, like, my code erroring once doesn't have the same like internal hurt as like baking a cake and it tasting horrendous. But in some ways, when you don't get that gratification, it's better when you code. And also, you've not just wasted like tons of ingredients.
So do you currently do a little bit of baking and then you go back and run your code? Do you do these things simultaneously now? And you can have like gratification times two.
Too risky. I kind of need to get in the zone of baking, I think. I think with coding, I can kind of get in the zone and phase and do other things, and, like, listen to music. But when I'm baking, I'm, like, so focused.
Mm-hmm. I like that. How did you make that move then? So from like baking and then you thought, okay, I'm going to go into coding.
I had always wanted to learn how to code. And I tried a few times, but I never really stuck with it. Almost like when you start watching a TV series and you don't get past the first episode.
Yeah.
And then you like try again, maybe like a few months later and a few months later, and then you mm-hmm. finally get past the first episode and you love it. That's kind of what coding was like for me, mm-hmm. where I think that I finally like stuck with it when I was in a place in my life where almost like the kind of like desperation was the mother of like invention. Like I needed to learn to code because I was in a place in my life where I really hated what I was doing. So mm-hmm. I needed to kind of change my life circumstance. And I think that that is what kind of propelled me to like really push through. And I think that once I was in it, I was like really in it. Like once I learned kind of like my first language or was halfway through the course, I was like, oh, this isn't too hard. And I also think that I kind of started with kind of training wheels. I think I started learning SQL. And mm-hmm. I think SQL is a good, because it's not really a programming language, but I think it's a good thing to learn to give you the confidence to be like, oh, I can code. And mm-hmm. I went from SQL to Python, which again, is not like Java or anything. Like it's a good way to like come into the industry.
So was that all self-taught? You just went online and learned all of these languages by yourself? Or did you go to a structured school?
All of my coding was self-taught. I literally, like, I think even to date, all of the coding courses I've probably done probably don't come to more than £100. My first course costed maybe like £12 on Udemy. My second course maybe costed £15 on Udemy because Udemy essentially always have a sale.
And so how many hours did you dedicate to all of that learning on average?
My first SQL course, I think in video lectures, was about 12 hours. And I think that was appropriate. I think you could probably teach someone SQL in far less than that, really. If you're sitting next to someone, I reckon you could probably teach someone SQL, basic SQL, in like an afternoon. But like, I guess it's like the principles of like programming and concepts and things like that. So maybe like 12 hours. Python was a bit longer. And I actually had my first kind of programming job before I finished the course. Because I would kind of learn it and then try and build something and then learn it and try and build something. And I was applying for jobs while I was doing the course and essentially just said I'd finished the course on my CV. And then I would do interviews and they'd be like, well, you need to do this thing. And I'd be like, yeah, sure, let's figure it out before the interview, which is kind of something that I think everyone should adopt. And I adopt till today, where like, if I kind of want a role and I don't know that technology, it doesn't really make sense in my mind to learn like infinite technologies before the role. So why not just apply and then learn it before I get there? I guess within reason, but that's kind of what I did back then.
It's probably easier to make it like for you to learn as well on the job and at the same time learning.
Yeah, I think that programming kind of people think it's much harder than it actually is. There are like different, I guess, languages are some are harder than others, I guess, and some like types of programming more, I guess, maybe conceptually might be difficult. But I don't think coding itself is that difficult. Mm-hmm. I think generally in almost every form of programming, you're just trying to solve a problem. So, and I think that, you know, most people have solved problems in their lives. Mm-hmm. So I think that if you have the right mindset and you approach it the right way, I think that anyone can really code.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's what you, like, that's, you got it on point there, which is it's a mindset rather than a particular skill or like thing that you need is rather mindset. You just have to have that mindset in order to get starting, get going and learning.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And it sounds like you were learning in a way that suited you in terms of your abilities and the way that you learned the best. So I know we talked about GCSEs and A-levels and degrees. Do you want to maybe tell our listeners about that journey and how you sort of progressed throughout the educational system?
So school was a bit weird, I think, because I am very dyslexic. Super dyslexic. Like sometimes I will forget the alphabet. So I'm like, yeah, I'm very dyslexic. But I wasn't diagnosed with dyslexia till I was 17 and did my ASs. and essentially like failed basically most of them. Like my grades were horrendous compared to my predicted grades. And up until that point, I was getting like decent grades, you know, fairly good. I was at the top of all my classes. Well, I was at the top sets of all my classes, let's say. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, like testament to my family, really, where they like really, like it was really important for me to like study, you know, and study when I got home. But the way my kind of brain works is that I take in information really quickly and like lots of, so I'd sit in class and just understand everything immediately. And I would kind of get homework in the class because I'd figured everything out. And then I'd do it in the class and hand it in the class. But given the kind of way my brain works and dyslexia that I have a horrendous short-term memory. So the way I kind of need to learn is through repetition, which was kind of the opposite way to how I was learning pre-knowing I'm dyslexic. So I would go to school, study everything, you know, do it in class and then hand it in. And then all that information I would have forgotten by the next day. So like that was fine until my GCSEs, but then my A-levels, I just couldn't handle it and I kind of failed everything. And then I was diagnosed with dyslexia and kind of had to do all my A-levels in 1 year and got kind of okay grades, but not like what I could have got, I guess. But then I think from that point onward, I was kind of in a place where I understood how my brain worked better and how I needed to study. And then it was kind of like a snowball from there where like I went to uni and then I did quite well at uni. And I knew that like because I didn't go to the uni I wanted, I needed to like really smash that to go to a better uni, I guess, to like have the name of a better uni. And that kind of like adopting to that new way of learning of like repetition and like, I guess, trial by doing or like learning by doing kind of really suited me. And I guess that's why programming is really good, because quite often you'll hit the same error or like you have the same problem. You have to try and fix it over and over again, or you'll be kind of doing similar things. And there's a lot of repetition with trying to solve problems. So that works quite well for me, really. I think that's one of the reasons why even without finishing courses, I would kind of try and solve problems around them and make quite a lot of progress. And I think that's why like I've kind of tried a lot of different careers. I think I've reset my career maybe like 3 times, but now I feel like programming and like coding and just like creative problem solving is something that I probably want to do indefinitely in some form.
I'm curious to learn, like, so for a young person such as yourself around when you were around 17 onwards, what sort of support was there for you in terms of understanding your neurodiversity, mm-hmm. the different coping mechanisms that maybe you'd had to learn? Was there someone that was there to support you with that?
Yes. And so I was really fortunate, and it feels like in retrospect a bit serendipitous, because we had a supply teacher who kind of covered our math classes for a year. And that was the year that I kind of had this realization, needed to learn. And he would like stay off of school and do detentions, and I would just stay with him, and he would like spend more time with me, like studying. And I think that it was almost like a master student sort of situation. And I think that like that extra time with him genuinely, I think, has changed my life. The fact that like that progress of me learning how to learn for me came from that time that I spent with him. And I feel really fortunate that like that was, he only worked at our school for that year, you know, and he put in a lot of extra time. And we kind of like have this weird relationship now where every like maybe 4 years or 5 years or whatever, we'll send each other an email. Like when I got into the University of York, I sent him an email essentially saying like, thanks so much for helping me. You know, like you've made like a massive difference in my life. Like I had really bad grades or like didn't get what I needed to do when we met, you know, and now I've gone to this really good uni, you know, essentially studying maths, you know, or like financial maths. So, and then he replied to me like years later, essentially saying like, I didn't feel worthy of your praise, you know. And when he replied to me, I was in a really bad place in my life at that point. So I felt I'd failed him. So now I'm still waiting to reply to him. And I really need to, but like,
what are you waiting for?
Yeah. I don't know. It feels like there's a lot of pressure riding on that email.
Well, you're doing amazingly well. I mean, he'd love to hear about your progress and achievements that you've made so far.
Send him this podcast. Yeah.
I will send him this podcast.
Nice plug.
Nice plug, Yen.
I have a question, actually, which is sort of taking it back a step, which is for those listeners who don't really understand what neurodiversity, like what it means to be neurodivergent, could you just elaborate and sort of, yeah, shine some
light? Yeah, sure. So I feel like people define it in like lots of different ways. And like the Cambridge Dictionary kind of defines it as like, they find it as like different to what is maybe normal or typical, or what is usual, I think is the phrase they use. I think it might be paraphrasing, you know, and they use the example of someone who has autism, which is, I guess, neurodivergent. But then like, I read a Harvard article, which kind of explains it as kind of the differences in how people experience the world and interact with the world around them. And that it's more about different ways of interaction, as opposed to deviance from what is normal. Because I guess like neurodiversity, like I guess any sort of diversity is a spectrum. Like there's like, you know, like a spectrum, I guess, of race. And there's like an infinite amount of, you know, I guess skin tones or eye colors or hair colors on that spectrum. And I think neurodiversity is exactly the same, where, yeah, you might have someone with very severe autism, you know, at one end of the spectrum, but you'll have someone completely different on the other end of the spectrum. And I think that, you know, neurodiversity is more about understanding how people interact with the world and how people understand information. And also, as, I guess, individuals, because everyone will be along that spectrum, understanding how your brain works and interacts with that in the world with respect to other people. Because I think quite a lot of the time you don't know that you might think in a different way, you might feel a certain way, and other people may not, or that might not be common. Like, I didn't realize that it wasn't common for people to forget the alphabet for a long time.
That's actually such a nice way of putting it. I think it really, when you give the example of forgetting the alphabet, so for, I guess, myself, when I'm thinking about that, I think, how is that even possible? Do you know what I mean? And for you, that is absolutely normal. So I think that's a really nice example, a simple example to put out there so that people understand what it really does mean and the differences that it brings. So I think some of the challenges we wanted to know about. So like typically, what was a challenge for you as a person that suffers from extreme dyslexia, particularly around the working world and data?
I think that... Well, initially, I think there's so much fear because it feels like you're limited. You know, like, I remember I always used to feel like it was like almost like a really cruel way to like, for your brain to work, for you to be like, I can understand things very easily, like really complex things, but I simply can't remember them. So I remember going into exams and being like, and it feeling like I knew the answer, but I just couldn't access that information. And I remember like, it used to really... like weigh in my mental health. I think that like for a lot of people when they have a diagnosis of like neurodivergency, if that's the correct word, they kind of go through this these like stages of like almost like feeling really bad and remorseful, and then they kind of lean on it as a crutch sometimes, and then you kind of move into a place where you're like, oh, this is actually like a superpower. Like I can use the, if I know myself and I can leverage these abilities, then it kind of puts me in a new space where I can do things that other people kind of can't. And kind of the perfect example for me is like seeing my partner who has ADHD, and she can accomplish like an entire workday in like 2 hours sometimes. Like some of the things that she will do in like such a short period of time are like mind-boggling. She like learned an entire programming language in like 3 hours and built like a mini app. And I was like, that is madness.
Like you touched on earlier about exams, right? And that we do exams, and it's actually quite sort of more tailored towards people who can actually remember and can actually retain those information. And I guess, yeah, so majority of people would and able to. So those exams are more for them, their potential in these exams.
Yeah, exactly. I think schooling, particularly like before uni, is a perfect, like most exams are just a memory test. So if you know that your memory is horrendous, but that's kind of like always going to be problematic. But then like for other people, like that is their kind of strong suit. Like the way that my partner studies is kind of amazing. She creates like a mental map of information that she can hold on to And then she almost doesn't need to really know the topic. She can just create a map of information and be able to navigate almost like 3D space in her mind and like be able to navigate information. Mm-hmm. So like, which is perfect for doing exams.
Yeah,
no, she definitely needs to share that with us, because any piece of information that can enable you to ace things, I definitely want to know how it's done. So I think we've talked about some of the limitations and I guess the downside of being neurodivergent. How about some of the advantages? We are talking about it as a superpower. So could you give us an example of ways that you've been using it as a superpower?
I think that now I feel like it's all superpower, or mostly superpower for me, like, because I can pick up like topics really quickly. You know, like I can learn how to do something. Like I can learn programming language really quickly, or I can like learn frameworks really quickly. Like my career has been really quick because I join a role, I learn everything about that role really quickly, and I either progress in that role or I go somewhere else. And like I think that I've like kind of progressed fairly quickly because I've leveraged that kind of superpower of being like, this is the pace my brain is going at. And I want to be, and I need to be somewhere where kind of that's the pace that I'm moving at, you know? So for me, it's been really helpful because I feel like I've learned a lot, like actually much faster than I guess some other people may be able to. And because now I know that, you know, like repetition is kind of the key to me retaining information, you know, I kind of can offset that kind of disadvantage that I have. And whereas like when I was younger, I never used to read, because the reading would feel like an eternity to me. So whereas now I read tons of books, because I listen to Audible. So I'm essentially constantly reading and constantly like taking in new information. So I think that getting around or like learning to compensate with maybe the struggles you might have has kind of turned that into kind of helped me leverage kind of the pros of, I guess, being super dyslexic. Because if I'm constantly listening to books and taking in information, I can then use that information I've taken in and put it into action really quickly with the kind of pro of my dyslexia. So it's actually kind of helped me a lot more than maybe other people might.
Yeah, no, going back to your career, and you know, you've mentioned that, you know, you've been through loads of jobs and you've had different career changes as well. How has your experience with being like neurodivergent changed over these times and over these sort of roles?
I think it's been interesting to meet different people who have, I guess, who in different places along the neurodivergent spectrum and seeing how they cope with their roles. And also like seeing how the world and its perception of neurodivergence has changed. Mm-hmm. Like when I joined, like started, I guess, my first job in what would have been 2015, you know, the perception of having dyslexia was probably very different, even though like I don't think it's where it needs to be. But
what was the perception then?
Essentially that you just couldn't read and that you'd mix up letters all the time. But I think that there are lots of misconceptions about, like, even within different, I guess, neurodivergent conditions where like they don't manifest themselves in the same way. I think ADHD is a perfect example where people when people think of ADHD, they think of like a naughty boy running around the classroom. Whereas like that, it presents itself vastly different in lots of different people. And also typically quite vastly different in men and women. So quite often women are wildly underdiagnosed with ADHD because people's perception of someone with ADHD is a naughty boy running around the classroom. So I think that throughout the world of work, it's been interesting to see how perceptions have changed and also what they are. Like sometimes I've had conversations with even managers in the past, and you know, and they're like visibly shocked when I tell them that I have dyslexia, because they're like, how can you work with all these numbers and all this data and things like that? Because they assume that someone who is dyslexic just wouldn't have that ability, or wouldn't have, I guess, the cognitive ability to be able to do that. Whereas that is kind of the perfect thing for me to be doing, really, because my brain works really well with patterns. So like seeing trends and patterns in data, and particularly with data engineering, which is like kind of essentially Lego for development, like building things, you know, that's kind of perfect for how my brain works.
And I think let's talk about the accessibility into data for a neurodivergent person in terms of the way interviews are structured, the tasks that are assigned to people. How does that allow people such as yourself into the data space or limit that?
So I think there are two sides to that, really, to like the process of interviews, because you kind of have, I guess, generally you want to figure out whether someone can do the job, right? Mm-hmm. But the ways you test someone, whether someone can do the job, are usually like really standardized, similar to like a school, and particularly in like programming and like tech and data roles, you know, they're very kind of standardized. And in some ways it can kind of like segment your pool of candidates, because you will essentially, like for like maybe like a whiteboard coding test or something like that, so only certain people will perform well in that scenario. Like, because it's a very specific set of skills that you're essentially asking for. You know, even if someone can do the kind of coding part, to do it in, you know, like on the spot, you know, with someone watching you.
I would fail 100%.
Same here.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, it got to a point where I was just like, I'm not doing any of that, because I just cannot perform in that scenario. Like, it stresses me out. I feel like really anxious. My brain cannot function in that way. And while I might be able to figure it out, you know, like in that scenario, I just don't function well. So what happens is that if a company always interviews like that, they will only have like a set of workers who think in a specific way. So I think that there's kind of disadvantage from an employer's point of view. But then also, I guess, as an employee, it will like disadvantage some people from applying. Mm-hmm. But the way that I've kind of leverage that is that if I apply for a role and that's what the interview process is like, I'll just say that I don't, like, I'm super dyslexic, you know, I don't perform well in this scenario. Is there anything that we can do? And if they're like, no, that's a sign that isn't a company to work for, because culturally, you know, I don't want to work for a company that is kind of rigid in that way. I think that says a lot about the employer. Whereas if they're like, oh, yeah, sure, like, we can, I don't know, like, send you a task or we can do something else. That says a lot. That says that company's culture, they're invested in, you know, in having, I guess, neurodivergent people, like people who think differently and think like different to what the typical, I guess, whiteboarding interview candidate would be like.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I've been participating and helping out with interviews in our organization. And when they do these type of tests where they have a candidate come in and code in front of the panel, it was explained to me because, oh, we need to be able to assess them and so that they can use their time that we allocate within the interview session rather than giving them a task that they'll have to do outside of their normal working hours. They could have children or additional caring duties and responsibilities. And I was just like, okay, yes, that is a reasonable thing to think about, but you're going to absolutely miss out on so many different people and their abilities by being so rigid in that way. And I guess in trying to serve a specific set of people and making things accessible for them, you're completely alienating another group of people. So it's really about what you said, for the candidate to be able to be strong enough to say, hey, by the way, I don't perform well in this scenario. Can we do it this way? And as you said, if they said no, then you know that's not the right space for you, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it's not easy for everyone to be able to do that. I think that I only began doing that when I felt like I was in a place in my career where I could be more choosy about what jobs I was taking, and like people who are new to the industry or like beginning might not feel that way. But I think from an employer point of view, it's only valuable to add more choices to that, because you'll just have a more diverse, like cognitively more diverse set of employees, and diversity in teams or in companies is just generally good.
You've got a lot to deal with being a Black man, being neurodivergent. So, you know, there's a lot of intersectionalities there. Can you talk about what sort of support that you've experienced, or maybe the support that you'd like to see from organizations to make the workplace a little bit more inclusive?
So I think it, again, it's like a very cultural thing. I think that companies kind of need to have a culture where you feel like you can be like, hey, you know, I'm dyslexic, so I've written this thing, and there are probably going to be lots of like spelling mistakes in it, so feel free to adjust it if you want to, you know. And I think that's a very cultural thing. I've worked for companies in the past where I've been like, I'm dyslexic, and people will be really annoyed for like the most minute things. And I'm like, well, there's not really much I can do about that, you know, like how my brain works. I'm sorry, you know. But I think that's very much a cultural thing. I think there are, I guess, like for me, I have a very specific view of kind of, because I guess dyslexia is one of those things where like you can't really see. And I guess it's only like one snippet of the neurodivergent spectrum. So I have kind of quite a unique view. And I think that maybe I might not be the best to speak about, because in programming, most of what I do, like I write something wrong and my like linter tells me that's wrong. Like I've written that variable name wrong and it will say that is wrong. It's not going to work. Sorry. You know, so I think that like maybe I've strategically chosen something that kind of offsets that for me, that says like, you know, generally I'm not too bad in that sort of area, because what I do probably isn't that kind of works quite well with my neurodivergence, you know, like for me, being dyslexic and programming works really well. And I think that also like the fact that a lot of my early programming was in Python helps a lot as well, because Python generally you're running it and it will just error if there's a problem. You know, and it will tell you that. Whereas you might be working in, I don't know, like JavaScript, and it won't immediately error. It just won't work. That's what you want to do, just won't appear sometimes. And that is more annoying. So, and then I have to like be more granular, I guess. Whereas I think that maybe I strategically chose something that worked really well with being really dyslexic. But there are like small things you can do, like wherever I go, I always install Grammarly on my laptop because that helps with email. So I like copy like an email into Grammarly or install the plugin just to like have an extra level of sense checking. Mm-hmm. Like some companies will kind of like fund that, which is really good as well. And then that kind of helps with that sort of thing.
Yeah. And do you think generally there's a better awareness and knowledge of neurodiversity now within organizations?
I don't. No, really. I think that tech companies I don't want to kind of speak out of turn, but I'm unsure. I think the culture of, I guess, today's world is more aware of differences in people's mental well-being generally.
Yes.
And I think that neurodivergency has been included in that by proxy. I think that because people are more aware of mental health and then, you know, kind of equating that to health in general, I think that by extension, neurodiversity has kind of been included in that as well. I think that maybe, you know, 10 years ago, you know, you saying I'm overwhelmed by this thing because, you know, I don't know, like I have ADHD and this thing has really overwhelmed me, or, you know, I just can't remember, or I have a sex and I can't remember any of those things in the meeting. I don't think it would have gone down as well 10 years ago. Whereas I feel like now, if I was in a meeting or in previous roles, I feel like it would be received better. And I think that people would genuinely put an effort to kind of understand. I think that generally people are putting in more effort to just understand how people think and feel differently, particularly in the world of work. And I think particularly in the world of tech, because it's generally more liberal for the most part.
Yeah,
which I think it just goes back to what you said earlier about how, you know, in your previous jobs, perception, and like 10 years ago, the perception was different until now.
Yeah.
All right. So I know you now live in the north of England. I'm sure it's very sunny and bright. I was trying to be kind, you know. We want to compare between the north and the south in terms of accessibility into data. So a lot of the work that we're doing within Black in Data is around opening up these spaces, particularly for people of color. And because we're based in London, so a lot of our efforts are sort of clustered around there. What opportunities are there within the north of England, and how do you see us helping in that regard?
So I think there's definitely like a big north-south divide. I think, I guess the north is massive and London is essentially its own country. And
as it should be.
So I think that like there's such, and I didn't realize it until I moved up north. And I'll speak to like my friends and my mum about the difference between the north and the south. And particularly like, I guess as a black person, and like it's like alarming how different things are. I think one of the things that I didn't realize I was privileged with being in London is that, you know, like I worked on Oxford Street while I was at school. You know, I was in the city all the time. You know, that's kind of like, I guess, where I hang out. And I think that being so close to all this kind of grandiosity makes it feel really attainable. So like, you know, like if I went for a walk, I was around like, you know, like Bank, and I would like go on school trips like the Bank of England and Bloomberg, you know, and things like that. And I think that made those things feel like really attainable. And there are some places in the north, like I guess like Manchester, which have that kind of big infrastructure. And when you're there, it feels like a big city. But there are lots of other places in the north which are cities which really don't feel that way. And I think that can from the like the schools I've been in and people I've spoken to, can affect that feeling of kind of more feeling attainable, or like feeling that you can kind of do whatever you want. Like even though I didn't go to the kind of the best school, I always felt like deep down, if I worked really hard, I could probably like achieve whatever I wanted really. And it was kind of realistically down to me, and there's obviously like lots of extemporaneous factors, but like really I felt like, you know, I was the master of my own destiny. Whereas in a lot of other places, they've never left, you know, what could be like, you know, like a 10-mile radius of their town from within a city. So the idea of, you know, more the city being attainable is just isn't something they've even considered. So I think that that's kind of like a privilege that you have in London that a lot of places outside of London don't really have. And I think that like when I go into schools and like you speak to some, and they're like, and they talk about, well, I've spoken to some kids and like some staff about like what they want to do, you know, a lot of things that they're almost hamstringed by experience, and, you know, the experiences that they've had because they've never left their like town or their sole subset of the city.
And in your expert role as an enterprise advisor, what sort of advice do you give young kids in terms of how to get into data or tech? What do you tell them?
Well, it's a fairly new experience for me. I've got an assembly planned in the near future, but a lot of what I'll talk about will just be about expanding their horizons. Like what you, I don't like, I want the kids to feel like they can do whatever they want, but what they really want to do. Yeah, and what they might want to be like, they might want to be like a YouTuber, but they also don't realize that to be a YouTuber, you're essentially managing your own production company until you like, you make it, you know, how much, you know, you need to be writing scripts, you need to be like working camera angles and like, you know, like building content, you need to be posting really regularly. Like you need to be managing like multiple social media channels. You know, like it's like a full-time job and then some. So I think that like, if that's what you want to do, that's great. You know, you should do that thing. But a lot of what I'll be talking about is making them aware that they can do what they want, but they need to be wide awake to what those things entail. And they can go as far or not far as they want. Like some people don't want to like, I don't know, be like the next big YouTuber. And some people don't want to be like the next big hairstylist. Like a lot of the girls want to, or a lot of the people want to, like going to like hairstyling and stuff, and I'm like, that's awesome. Do you realize like how complex this field is, and like the science that goes behind like coloring hair is madness. Like it's so complex, and like some people might want to do that really like complex thing, but some people might want to not do that, and that's fine as well. And I think that like a lot of my talks with the schools will be about like getting them in a place where they feel comfortable pursuing kind of whatever they want and having their eyes open to what that thing will entail in future.
It's really refreshing to hear from someone that will give you the real insights of it doesn't all, you know, mean that you're going to fail. You know, you might fail in your studies, but there are options. And exactly. Being able to tell people about options is about empowering them, right? Letting them know that the sky is potentially the limit. That leads us to the very end of the podcast. I feel like we could talk for another 800 hours. So thank you very much for your time, Jesse. I've really, really, really enjoyed our discussion with you. And I hope you stay in touch with Black in Data and we can continue to do more collaborations and work with the children, with yourself.
Yeah. No, thank you so much. Thanks, yeah, Jesse. It's been really, really interesting. Thank you for the trial run of my assembly after like...
All right. Thank you very much, Jesse.
If you'd like to find out more about us, please visit our website, which is www.blackindata.co.uk. You can email us at hello@blackindata.co.uk if you wish to take part in a podcast, or if you have ideas of topics you'd like us to discuss. You can even email us just to say hi. You can help us grow our community by joining us on LinkedIn. Just search Black in Data. Our Twitter and Instagram handle is black_in_data. Let's keep talking.